Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassami. We're into the waxing moon of Vaisakh, so next one prat will be the full moon of Vaisakh, which is the day we celebrate the life of the Buddha, the birth, enlightenment, and parinibbana of the Buddha. I was just going over some of the readings. It's one of my favorite stories, the life of the Buddha. It's a very, very beautiful story. Sarah Miles, who is a famous actress, who is my age, so she's probably not so famous now. She lives next to Chithurst. And her husband was the, not the director, but the screenwriter for Dr. Zhivago. I forget his name. He got an Oscar. Sometimes the bhikkhus would go down to Sarah's place and talk with Sarah. She's an English eccentric actress. Her husband was doing a screenplay for The Life of the Buddha. And I think Ajahn Sachit or Ajahn Kuruniko asked him, "How's it going?" And she said, "It's a difficult story. He's a good guy that got better." So the things that have been done in the life of the Buddha usually are up to the enlightenment. But from the enlightenment onwards, there's no sex, drugs, and rock and roll, or there's just good teachings and so on. Although there's some good stories, the difficulties the Buddha had. In any case, it's a story I love to read every year, just to inspire me, and because that's my tradition. And stories are where's the truth and where's mythology, but stories have a purpose. Stories can be seemingly very embellished, so if you're a hardcore realist, any sense of embellishment might seem a bit smarmy, or but embellishments bring imagination. And imagination brings possibilities, brings uplift. So we have imagination. We can use imagination. And in the texts, the birth of the Buddha is given by Venerable Anand, one of the instances of Venerable Anand, who was the attendant to the Buddha for the last 25 years or so. He's sitting with a group of monks in Shravasti in Ajanta Grove, and he's conveying some stories about the wonder and marvel of the Buddha. And the Buddha walks in on their discussion, and everyone's quiet, and the Buddha asks them, "So what were you talking about?" And then the Venerable Ananda says, "We were talking about the marvelous qualities of the Lord." And so the Lord Buddha says, "So what marvelous qualities are you talking about? Let me know what you were talking about." So Venerable Ananda gives the whole birth story then, which he says, "And these are the words I heard from you." So Venerable Ananda had a photographic memory, and one of the stipulations he had for being the attendant to the Buddha was that any teaching that he was not present to, the Buddha would repeat so that he could know the entire teaching. And in the first council, Venerable Ananda recited the teachings from memory. And so in the suttas you have the phrase, "Thus have I heard," which is the Venerable Ananda's voice speaking, giving his memory of what the Buddha said. So he's been describing the life of the Buddha, and this is just the last two paragraphs, and this is from the Majjhima Nikaya. When the Bodhisattva, so this is the Buddha asking Anand, Venerable Anand, and Venerable Anand is reciting what he heard from the Venerable, from the Lord Buddha's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, a great measureless light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared in the world with its deities, its Maras, and its Brahma divinities, in this generation with its monks and Brahmins, with its princes and men. And even in those abysmal world interspaces of vacancy, gloom, and utter darkness, where the moon and sun, powerful and mighty as they are, cannot make their light prevail, there too a great measureless light, surpassing the splendor of the gods, appeared, and the creatures born there perceived each other by that light. So it seems that other creatures have appeared here. And this 10,000-fold world system shook and quaked and trembled, and there too a great measureless light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared. All these things I heard and learned from the Blessed One's own lips, and I remember them as wonderful and marvelous qualities of the Blessed One. So you get a feeling something significant has happened. This is how it's done. But what I really, I mean, I love that, but I love the Buddha's rejoinder to that. So that being so, Ananda, remember also this as a wonderful and marvelous quality of a perfect one. A perfect one's feelings of pleasure, pain, or equanimity are known to him as they arise, known to him as they are present, and known to him as they subside. His perceptions are known to him as they arise, known to him as they are present, and known to him as they subside. His thoughts are known to him as they arise, known to him as they are present, and known to him as they subside. And that also I remember, Lord, as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. That is what the Venerable Ananda said. The Master approved, the bhikkhus were satisfied, and they delighted in the Venerable Ananda's words. And why I like that so much is because it takes you back to the ordinary. So this is what a Buddha knows. Because we can we hear marvelous things about enlightened beings, and it all seems so sometimes very far away, the profundity of their experiences in some way, maybe it is. But this we can do. That being so, Ananda, remember also this as a wonderful and marvelous quality of a perfect one. So all those things that Ananda is describing, the Buddha says, yeah, but this is also marvelous. A perfect one's feelings of pleasure, pain, or equanimity are known to him as they arise. So a Buddha is feeling pain, pleasure, and equanimity. Right? So he's not kind of out of the business of being, he's still a sense being. As they arise, known to him as they are present, and known to him as they subside. His perceptions, so he still has perceptions, obviously. How do you interpret the world without perceptions? His perceptions are known to him as they arise, known to him as they are present, and known to him as they subside. His thoughts, so there's still thought, are known to him as they arise, known to him as they are present, and known to him as they subside. So what does the Buddha know that others don't know? Just that. And that's the constant formulation that you get in Buddhist practices. To have the presence of mind, to know change. It's not really so far away, but it's terribly difficult in a curious kind of sense, because we don't really give priority to that. We don't give priority to the perception of change. We give priority to the quality of the experience, and so we get lost. And I was saying that I think Saturday, whenever I said this, to kind of been contemplating how, you know, how do we pay attention, and why do we give priority to our neuroses, say? Why does that happen? Why do our hang-ups and things which we know are shallow or silly or foolish or whatever, why do we give them so much airtime? And why do we give them so much mental space? Why are they so important when we maybe have been through those same cycles a million and one time? Why does that happen? And how can we not invest so much time in those things? How can we divest, or how can we prioritize something else? Well, part of the problem is just the force of what we call vipaka kamma, resultant kamma, the result of, like one of the monks was telling me that he had a lot of movies coming up on a retreat. And why did that happen? Well, because he watched a lot of movies in his life. So even though the intention is to, there's the understanding of that, that's not rocket science, it's pretty easy. And even though there might be kind of some sense of that's true, and one wants to aspire to that, the force of habitual tendencies is so powerful, it keeps overwhelming or kidnapping or taking over the mental space. And that's the force of accumulated habits. That's what vipaka kamma, resultant kamma is. We say kamma is intention. Why we get into the kind of attitudes and thoughts and so on that we get into. What's behind it? What's the energy behind it? Why do we do it? That's kamma, the intention behind it. And the resultant is vipaka kamma, resultant kamma. And kamma is in the West seen quite often as a kind of fatalism or kind of a crime and punishment sort of mindset, but that's not what it's about. It's more like the accumulated, or there might be that aspect of it, I don't know what, but there's the sense that these are the accumulated habits. And one can see if one has, you know, intensely watched movies for 10, 15 years and really enjoyed them and put a lot of effort into that, the resultant kamma is going to be that's a force in the mind. It's an energy in the mind that comes up and it occupies mental space. And that you can't really do much about. That's already there. That's a given. That's part of your curriculum that you have to learn from. So just getting rid of that in some kind of a repressive way, that won't work either, because there's still an engagement with wrong intention, an engagement with the habits of mind with wrong intention. So what really directs our practice is wisdom. And in Buddhism, when we talk about the Noble Eightfold Path, we're always mentioning right understanding or right view. And that's really primary, because that's samadhi, right, understanding, leads to sammasankappa, or right thought, or right intention. You see, so it's if the intention is perverted by greed, hatred, and delusion, there's going to be resultant kamma, habitual patterns, which will be in the flow of greed, hatred, and delusion. It can't be any other way. It's just the law of kamma. So the thing is to get right view, get right understanding. And if you don't have right understanding, if we don't have right understanding, we're going to suffer. And that suffering is going to be knocking on our door, saying, it's not working, it's not working, not doing something right. And we are actually built for enlightenment, because we have desire. And we have the desire to be peaceful or happy or fulfilled. We all have that. And we have more than just animal desire, because we're not fulfilled just by sex and food and safe living. You know, there's something deeper in us which is, aspires to something. And so this desire we have, this aspiration we have, won't be satisfied until we understand this. And so it's like a stone in your shoe. You know, this stone is going to keep bothering you until you figure it out. So right understanding is a kind, it comes from the willingness to see, well, what is the problem? Well, you know, why does my mind keep going there? Why does it keep doing that? Why does it keep doing that? And then the intention is to, has to be free from, it has to be free from the craving for experience. That's the trick. If you crave a certain experience, you'll never be free from experience. So the craving for experience, be it negative, like I don't want this experience, be it positive, I want another experience, through memory or through some speculation or idea, that craving for experience will always lead you to disappointment, death, and despair. So the right understanding is that the nature of experience arises. It's not all, like you begin to see that all experience is contingent on many things, and it comes. So you begin to see, so you have some obsessive grumbling about someone or about yourself, and that began. And to have the faith to not try to change it, to not seek another kind of experience, but to begin to really pay attention to this experience that you have now without the desire to get rid of it or to get another experience, to replace it, to analyze it, to do anything about it, just to know purely as it is. That's simple. Well, so why don't we do that? Because, well, as soon as we notice that we've been thinking or obsessing, then we want to get rid of that. And so we either go to a meditation object to get rid of it, or we start to judge or analyze, why am I like that? But just the pure awareness of it, we don't wait and just let it be as it is. We don't have the patience oftentimes. But if you have the patience and you have the faith and trust and insight that this truly will end, then you very quickly start to notice the ending of it. You start to notice that. You start to have faith in endings. And faith in endings isn't a looking for a different experience. I know when I started meditating, I would go to the breath with a desire to not be with thought. So the thought would come up, and then I would grab the breath as an alternative focus, but I was always trying to get rid of thought. So I was still seeking an experience. So the experience of breathing seemed to be much more pleasant. That's what they told me to do, and it was in a way, but I never saw the end of thought. I just pushed thought away, and very quickly, good intention. And it was better than just rambling on all the time, but it really didn't give a good result. But then, just like sometimes, say, when you're meditating, and just sometimes as you live your life, sometimes there's nothing much going on. You know, you're just ho-hum, and things come and go. And sometimes you just get a storm of rubbish, just like a storm of fear, or a storm of self-doubt, or again, a storm of feeling alienated, or whatever it is, lustful. And there's just this kind of huge energy comes up into consciousness. And that's actually very good. That's all very good if you see it that, now this is a chance to really practice, as we say. So this is a chance to really notice change. So as something really strong comes up into the mind, if it has a lot of force, you'll notice its ending, and you're going to have to notice its ending maybe for half a day. You're just going to have to be on the practice. You just have to really work hard at it, because it's it's a storm coming up. It's been triggered by someone's comment to you, or some diagnosis of an illness, or something in the family. Yeah, these things trigger us. These trigger off different kinds of vipaka kammas. So someone comes and says, a year ago you did something and I think you shouldn't have done that. And you look at the guy and you kind of, you can't say that to me. And you feel really indignant or self-righteous or whatever. And then that churns through your mind, doesn't it? It churns through there. That's not wrong. It's not pleasant, but it's not wrong for you to feel that, because you're feeling it. It's just the vipaka kamma. And that's part of right view, is that to feel a storm of anger or fear or lust, or there's nothing wrong with it. It's just natural. But what's the practice around it? So right view is that it has arisen, it belongs, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. Right view is acceptance. Not condolence, and not passivity, kind of, oh, this is my karma to be whatever, but just, yeah, this is happening now, and it's a part of my history or whatever, and now's a chance to work with it. You know, that's part of right view. And from that right understanding, which is acceptance, but attention, you're attending, you realize just to follow this now it's going to give bad consequences. But you don't have to repress it, you have to bear with it. You have to witness it. You have to be patient with it. And that's right understanding. You see, now, if you have right understanding, that's going to make your intention appropriate. If I don't understand this as vipaka kamma, if I take it personally and think, oh gosh, my meditation is terrible, or I shouldn't be doing this, whatever judgment you make, and then you come from that judgment that it shouldn't be this way, I shouldn't be this way, I should have something else, then that judgment will be a perspective, a ditti, a viewpoint, and from that viewpoint you'll make intentions, right? We'll make intentions, we'll make thinking. And those intentions will be in line with aversion, repression, not wanting, self-judgment, self-hatred. And those intentions won't give a skillful result, because they're not grounded in right understanding, they're grounded in wrong understanding. And that's what we mean by ignorance in Buddhism. Ignorance is not just, you know, it's not a matter of IQ, it's a matter of wisdom. And that, as I gave that example, ignorance of the law of gravity does not excuse you from the law of gravity. It's just, you know, you have to understand the law of gravity. And that's what the Dhamma is. When we say refuge in Dharma, it's really understanding that these things that have arisen are the consequences of past activity and past habits, and there is nothing right or wrong with them. But the freedom is not in the experience, another kind of experience, but in the knowing of them as that which is changing. Now that doesn't seem like much of a freedom, because these powerful things that are very unpleasant, you don't want them. You might have seen them a million times before, and so on. So, you know, it doesn't seem like much. But you know, why is the Buddha saying that to Ananda? And why is he saying that? He's not saying to Ananda, you shouldn't feel angry. He's saying that this is what a Buddha knows. He knows something arising, something enduring, something ceasing. He knows that. That's what he knows. And that knowing is, it's a kind of, it's not the knowing of a scholastic position, is it? It's like, you're on the mark, you know. It's just like when I'm working on the saw, and it's dangerous. You know, be careful. You're too speedy. Go have a coffee. No, go have a tea. No, go lay down. So that saw is telling me to be careful, isn't it? And that's wisdom, rather than just that I've seen YouTube pictures of people who've chopped their fingers off on the saw. You know, it's different. I know this thing's dangerous. So in the same way, like really knowing the Dharma is knowing this has arisen. There's nothing right or wrong with it. That, you know, it just has arisen. It'll hang in for a while and it'll cease. And that perspective is where you need faith and understanding and wisdom. Because if you can sustain that perspective in these great storms of fury that we can sometimes endure, or just in the ho-hum mundaneness of life, if you can just persist and watch, then you start to realize the freedom of the end of these storms. A freedom which is not one based upon replacing the storm with a lollipop or an ice cream cone. It's based upon the end of karma, the end of this vipaka kamma, something beyond the storm, not just another kind of experience. That takes faith. But the faith is based upon right understanding. Well, how else could you do it? That's, you know, how else are you going to do this? If something else works, fine. You know, fine. But how else? So this is what the Buddha recommends to us. And we get this, you know, again and again and again. But the application of that, kind of, we just seem to need to be reminded. You know, we get so caught up in these dramas and scenarios, and then we try to repress them or get rid of them. In a monastery, then, because it's for most guests and for most people, it's a pretty uncomplicated situation. But that doesn't mean that your buttons don't get pressed. It doesn't mean that someone really ticks you off or disappoints you, or you get infatuated with, or you get intimidated by. It doesn't, you know. The simplicity of the situation doesn't mean your buttons don't get pressed. So if your buttons get pressed, that's actually an incredibly good opportunity to look at vipaka kamma, the resultant kamma of things which, you know, you kind of know you have this stuff, don't you? You know it'll come up. And then what comes up in a monastery, and, well, I didn't come here for that. I came here for peace. But actually, this is kind of the ideal opportunity, isn't it, to look at something like that. So if a button gets pressed in a place like this, then you have so much space to look at it. You have so much freedom and lack of fear. The thing about a monastery is you don't have to perform as a personality. You still have to dig the ditch if you're asked to dig the ditch or dig the garden hole or whatever, but you don't have to like it. You don't have to be ebullient and charming and you know, you just have to kind of function, do what you're asked to do, and then within that you can watch disappointment, boredom, whatever. You have a chance to watch, and this like waiting for the meal, it's a really good time just to kind of put the world down. It's like you're sitting here, there's nothing happening, no one's saying anything. Sometimes, you know, when you're in social situations, you think something should be happening. So there's a kind of anticipation. But just to come into the shrine room before the meal or before the sitting and just, this is the way it is now. Use the kind of spaces in monastic life, the waiting for the meal, waiting for the meditation to start, waiting for the meditation to finish. Use those spaces where there's nothing happening to look at the mind which is always wanting something to happen, the mind which is future-oriented or always wants to talk and engage with people and be charming or be funny or whatever, all that stuff. It's okay, there's nothing wrong with it. But also, there are other opportunities to just look at this impulse to be a personality. We're not wrong, because we don't want to walk around as some kind of dead drones. And, you know, these things are good. But it's just that the push of like needing to say something or needing to do something. Or like I have that when there's a lot of people in the room and I'm sitting here and people are looking at me. Imagine how I feel. And it's like, do I feel self-conscious because people are looking at me? Yes, they're looking at me. So I can have this feeling, well, I should be saying something. You know, I should be charming or interested in people, right? Which is actually a kind of nervousness, isn't it? A kind of nervousness. But I can look at that too. I can look at just the sense of being in front of people, being the teacher, like having to say something wise, or like giving these talks. And like I have to say something to inspire, or something really clever or wise or whatever. So that's a sense of self that arises, right? And the social situation demands or asks of me to fulfill my responsibility, so I do that. But then the ego sense, like, should say something wise, or if everyone's falling asleep, say something funny, then say everyone feels entertained and they think it's a great talk, so on and so forth. So that becomes a performance. And then people say, oh, that was a really good talk, Bhante. You should put that on YouTube. And then I'm stuck, the kind of bhikkhu performer, always having to give stories, funny stories, so everyone's happy, 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 happy. Oh, he's a wonderful monk. That's a trap, isn't it? Huh? But to actually kind of give a boring talk where he says, oh, I heard that again. People falling asleep on me. You know the story of Ajahn Sumedho, what Rinpo Cha asked him to do? You've probably heard this one. We have these all-night sittings in Thailand. All night. Sit through till 4 in the morning. And the monks give talks through the night. Lay people come and sit up. And Rinpo Cha would give the first talk, and then other monks would follow suit. So if you got the kind of graveyard shift at 2 in the morning, there weren't too many customers left. And so Rinpo Cha asked Rinpo Sumedho, Ajahn Sumedho at that time, and he said, Sumedho, go give a talk. So he gets up on the Dharma seat, gives 45-minute talk. And he starts to get down, and Rinpo Cha says, keep talking. He made him talk for like almost 3 hours. And at the end of it, there's no one left. They all left. And he said he gave one talk where he prepared the talk. It was all kind of good lists and really clever things, and Rinpo Cha said, don't ever do that again. Just speak from your heart. So, and then this other one, this talk where everyone finally left, because who gets left in these all-night sittings? That usually there's, you know, like 80% women, village women, and 20% men. The men go first. And the last women left are the really tough, older women who are usually actually chewing betel nut during the talk. And they have these very delicate ways of spitting the betel juice out into their Ovaltine tins. And they're great. They're great meditators. But when they're gone, you know you've been deserted. There's just nothing left. And so Rinpo Sumedho really used that well, because, you know, what were you talking to? And he just watched. He said it really helped him just to give a talk, even if no one's interested, everyone's falling asleep, just to give a talk. And he gives wonderful talks. He gives wonderful talks. So whatever social situation we're in, whatever buttons we get pressed, the main thing is really to really see how the mood of the mind conditions a sense of self, and that sense of self is not a true entity, it's just a configuration dependent on the mood. So I get stimulated by someone who praises me, I get stimulated by someone who disparages me, I get stimulated by people they would look at me, or work I don't want to do, work I do want to do, da 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 da. So that we don't become kind of needy. You know, monastic life isn't a kind of needy thing where I need I need you to approve of me, or I need, it's not, you know, monastic life isn't a relationship. Sometimes people want a relationship with the monks or a teacher, but it's not that. It's like monastic life isn't therapy. Like somehow monks are available for therapy to work through your problems. That's not what it's about. It's like if you have a Dharma question, you ask, but they're kind of, sometimes you get very kind of needy sense. You need attention, need to be recognized, need to be praised, huh? And that you can watch. And you can say, what happens if I don't watch that and I act that out? Well, there's no freedom. My sense of security is always dependent on that need being fulfilled by someone else. So the very sense of lack or the sense of need that comes up in consciousness, if we can look at that in a kind of pre-verbal sense, you know, the sense of I need something from a place or a person, and look at that with just a sense of need, wanting something, and bear witness to it, it's come to consciousness, stays a while and ceases. That cessation is the third noble truth, which is synonymous with Nibbana or Nirodha, the cessation of need, the cessation of lack, you know, the sense of lack, I need something, I'm lacking something. And these are such primal energies that we usually don't see them in their primal form. We're already kind of, we've already abstracted them with thought into all kinds of ideas and projections, and become third or fourth hand, but to come back. Well, the very sense of feeling of lack. I just said, what is that like? That's good practice. And then you bear witness to it, you're patient. So the endurance and persistence part of it, you know, like again, if one has a storm of resentments coming up for some reason, a storm of insecurities coming up, you know, to practice means you just have to be determined to, each one that comes up, it comes up like 100 a second or 1,000 a minute, you're on each one. This is ceasing. You see it end. You just keep observing in that way. Have faith in that. That's persistence. That's endurance. That's patience. That's trust. There's also wisdom. The endurance isn't just from some kind of idea that I have to endure. It comes from the right understanding. And the right understanding is non-attachment, non-grasping, vipaka-kamma, coming up into consciousness, the willingness to just let it go through you, let it process through you. So there's a willingness, an allowingness, and yet this kind of acuity of attention. So on one hand, you have the kind of compassion, it all belongs, as Ajahn Sumedho says, this openness of allowing. But on the other hand, you have this wisdom, which is like a razor. It just knows, this has arisen, has ceased, arisen, ceased. You have these both. It's interesting. You have this kind of sharpness of attention, but openness of heart. And I think the right practice needs both of those. So the openness of the heart is the allowing. The acuity is the non-indulgence, or the knowing that this is just sankharas, this is just khandas, this is just thought, this is just memory, this is just bodily feeling, this is just pleasant, this is just unpleasant, this is just neutral. Just knowing that, that's all it is. It's nothing more. So compassion allows, wisdom lets go. Sometimes our sense of openness isn't very in the forefront, because we can be very judgmental, self-critical, repressive, blaming, and so on. So that openness is lacking. But sometimes we're kind of so open, we're just lost in it. Just kind of go with it all the time. There isn't a kind of acuity around cessation, the ending of something. And the mixtures of those and changes in those and such like. So that the shift from, you know, to right understanding is a sense of opportunity. The sense from self-judgment and idealism and those kinds of things, there's a sense of failure. I'm not getting anywhere. My practice is down the tube. This isn't good. I need therapy. But from right understanding, you don't need therapy. You need to let it come up. You need to be with it. You need to have the guts to just watch it and witness it and until it ceases. And that gives you a lot of... when you see that that works, you get a lot of confidence. You just feel really confident, even though the stuff coming up is utter rubbish. And that's interesting contrast. The utter rubbish is coming into your mind, old habitual rubbish, and you have this deep confidence that it's just rubbish. That's all it is. It's not me. It's just stuff coming up. So you work with that. You keep working with that. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Annoyam mukataya sadhu karang dadavase sa